This is the Eurosnob Podcast.
All right, so we would like to welcome you in to another episode of the Eurosnob Podcast. Little bit different than our normal episodes. I mean, it's all the same for us, but we're finally sharing the YouTube links with all of you so you can tune on in and check us out. Watching the viewer number there, hopefully we get a couple coming on here. But if not, it's still the same old podcast, still joined by the same people. I'm Ian, joined by Alex.
What and up?
The media hitman, Bill. Gentlemen.
How you guys doing?
We're doing, man, doing. Hanging in there. Typical Arsenal, typical, well, shit, my typical sports existence continues. And let's go Bills, right? Got to get back on track this week.
Oh, believe me, I know the feeling. Every team I root for, except for the LA Kings, is failing right now. So hockey is my new favorite sport.
Yeah. Bill sitting over there with his Eagles hat all smug and shit.
It's an anomaly season, and I will take anything I can get being an Arsenal fan right now. So to do that.
That's the thing, though, about the Eagles. It's not, because you guys finally have a quarterback.
Yeah, it's a joy to watch somebody that actually prepares and does some homework. And there's a lot of good athletes around them, and everybody seems to work together as a team. And that's what I'm hoping to ask for some Arsenal players to do going forward.
So. Right. Yeah, probably a good thing. Let's bring it over to the Arsenal. Obviously, Arsenal not quite as successful as those Eagles have been this season. Kind of had a rough one this weekend, at least by the scoreline. You know, obviously a 3-1 loss at City. Alex, what are you just kind of right off the bat? You know, and I guess before we jump into that, I just want to let you guys know, anybody who's here for the U.S. soccer side of things, we're going to be jumping into that a little bit later on in the podcast. So if you really don't care about Arsenal, we suggest you listen and start caring about Arsenal. But, you know, feel free to kind of skip ahead a little bit and catch up on that U.S. national team stuff. But right back to that City game. Alex, what were kind of your initial thoughts from that out of that game?
It was one of those games where I went into with a bit of trepidation, just because it is City and they've been in such good form lately, and quite frankly, we haven't been. So, you know, I didn't go into it with a great feeling. I saw the lineup, my feeling got worse. And that, you know, it was one of the things where, you know, for the initial part of the game, we didn't look overawed by the occasion. We didn't look like we were necessarily intimidated. But then they get that early goal by De Bruyne, and you're kind of thinking, oh, here we go again. You know, to our credit, we stuck in there. But then we give away that penalty. I believe it was early in the second half. And at that point, you're thinking, game might be over. But, you know, to the team's credit, they fought back. They got a goal. And then something I'll get into later, the offside decision or the lack thereof, basically put the game out of reach. But all in all, it was a game where I think we set ourselves up to fail from the beginning with how the team lined up and the personnel selection. And then I think City's higher level talent kind of came through and kind of shone. And then obviously there were some refereeing decisions that we'll get into, but I'll also toss it over to Bill, just kind of your initial thoughts on the game and how it unfolded.
You know, you hit the nail on the head. You always go into those games with trepidation anymore, which really shouldn't be the case, but it always seems to be the case with that top six record that Arsenal are currently holding. And, you know, was hoping to kind of, they look good early. I think the first 10 to 15 minutes or so, it looked pretty good. And then the first goal by KDB came in. Kind of seemed like it should have been saved or attempted a little bit better, in my opinion. But other than that, you had the penalty decision, which, I mean, you see shoulder-to-shoulder decisions not get given for penalties like that all the time, usually against Arsenal, like when an Arsenal player would go down. They're not given. And the third goal was just typical. I mean, you could just write this story over and over again. It's Bill Murray Groundhog Day, just repeated. You know, something happens, they look good, a goal, then a penalty, then they come back, and then offside goals allowed in, handballs allowed in, something goofy happens against Arsenal and the refereeing doesn't go that way. And it's just getting kind of frustrating. So those are my overall thoughts, kind of similar to yours.
Yeah, I mean, you guys are both right there. But I think as far as how we performed on the field, I didn't think we were too bad. Obviously, there are some questions about the setup coming into the game. I think when we all saw the lineup out there, we instantly thought, okay, Wenger's gone back to a 4-2-3-1. Even the media was kind of saying the same thing. I think it was Kyle Martino was talking about it, saying, okay, Arsenal, you know, you saw the stats going out, and he talked about it and said that when they played last year against a low-scoring team, that's when they went to the three at the back, and against a high-scoring team, they went to four at the back. You know, and I think we all kind of gave – so we're kind of giving Wenger a little bit of credit that maybe he was figuring something out, you know, that maybe he was adapting his team to our opponent. Why we thought he would do that, I mean, he's never done that ever.
Right.
So all of a sudden we all kind of thought that that's what he would do. Maybe it was all – obviously it was just wishful thinking because he set out with Coughlin the center back of a three, which is insane to me. In all fairness to Coughlin, I'm going to give him a little bit of credit here. For what he was asked to do, I thought he was fine. He didn't do anything spectacular. He was a little bit out of position from time to time, but he made some good tackles. I mean, for what we asked him to do, he didn't kill us.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I didn't mean to interrupt. I just say I'd agree with that. I mean, I think we all kind of saw – It is exactly like you said. When I saw the initial lineup come out, I said, all right, we're playing 4-2-3-1. And then all of a sudden, I think within the first minute, the announcer said, oh, and Coughlin's playing center back. And I said, oh, that's unfortunate. So we'll probably chalk this one up as a loss. And I'll see you guys in 2 weeks for Tottenham. But you know, it was one of those things where, yeah, I honestly, to his credit, he was not one of the biggest problems in that game at all. Yeah, his passing out of the back is limited. He's not a good distributor of the ball, but he wasn't out of position. You know, anything that came his way, he dealt with. I think there were way bigger concerns in Coughlin in this game. But it is like you said, you know, I kind of thought he might try to adjust the team for City's personnel. I will say, apparently, Rob Holding was ill and then Mertesacker had an injury. So I sort of get the reasoning behind it, if that's the case. But it's one of those things where now you see Gabriel shining at Valencia and you're wondering, oh, wouldn't he be useful right about now?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously something because, I don't know. Let's put it this way. I'm not missing Gabriel. He scared me as much as any player that I can ever remember in recent memory for Arsenal, so I'm not really upset that he's no longer with us.
But Valencia hasn't lost a game in 8 games with him starting.
There's no arguing he's been good for them. I mean, you can't argue that, but I don't know. I just don't think he was ever very good for us. Whatever that reason is, was it the language? Who knows?
Could it also just be our defensive setup, though? I mean, we've made a lot of good defenders look really bad. You know,
there's no doubt about that. It absolutely could be. You know. But despite all that, I mean, I thought defensively we were decent. I mean, you're not going to ever stop City. You're not going to stop them. They're scoring 4 goals a game right now. You're not going to stop them. The fact that, you know, the KDB's goal, like Bill, you said it, Czech should have done better. The penalty, honestly, I thought it was weak. Do I understand why he called it? Yes. Do I think it was a dive? Yes. But, okay, you can't put yourself in that position. The third goal was offside. So, you know, very easily that game is, you know, all 3 of those goals are preventable and not necessarily through anything that we did overly wrong, if that makes any sense. I don't know if I explained that all that well. So I think defensively we were fine. You know, the issue for me was in the final third, and there's 2 people that it really comes down to, and that's Alex Iwobi and Alexis Sanchez. Also, I'm going to send those over to Bill. I mean, between those two, which one do you think was the bigger problem?
I mean, that's a dynamite question. you know where my bias would lie with that question. I think you're going to be surprised at what my answer is actually going to be right now. And Alexis Sanchez really bothered me watching his play. I mean, 15 times, I think the statistic was, he turned the ball over in the first half. I think that was the stat that was roaming around there. I mean, that's unheard of. I mean, Iwobi, I just can't understand the allure. And, you know, for what he was asked to do and what he does, you know, he doesn't do a bad job. He's just so indecisive in the final third. He has no end product. And I just always use that phrase, because if he did, I think he'd be very, very good. But besides that, I mean, his defensive abilities just aren't there in terms of pressing and doing what I think they were trying to do. But Sanchez, for me, was the bigger problem with the just – I know this is a crazy conspiracy thought, but it's like Oxlade-Chamberlain. I tweeted that. You play him before the team he went to or wanted to go to, and you're trying to prove a point by saying, oh, he's going to do so well against you, and he just looks disillusioned. You know, he really did. It was – I don't know if you guys agree with that or not.
I guess what I would say to that is, if you didn't play him – and you lost the game,
right? You'd be
then
right.
The complete opposite story would run. Like I definitely get what you're saying. The turnover stat. I don't know if it was 15 in the first half or 15 overall, but I think it was like he turned the ball over 15 times, and then the entire team aside from him turned it over like 18 times.
That might have been it.
Yeah. So he was responsible for so much of that, and it is like you said. I mean, I don't know if he was mentally checked out. I don't know if City's pressing kind of messed with his game. I really don't quite understand what happened. To Ian, kind of to your point, the match stats, I'm looking at them right now, were really not that skewed. You know, the possession was about 58-42. City had 4 shots on target. We had 3. City had 4 goal attempts off target. We had 3. Fouls are about even. Corners were about even. You know, so they did dominate the possession and probably completed way more passes. But, you know, defensively, we were fine. I mean, that De Bruyne shot, it was hit bottom corner. I mean, I might give Cech a little bit of a pass there. Penalty, Bill, like you said, you see those shoulder-to-shoulder challenges not get called. And,
right,
you know, the way Sterling went about it, he kind of stuck his left leg out so that Monreal would catch it while trying to also put a body on him, and so he went over very easily. And I mean, third goal, you can't get more offside than that. You have to almost intentionally not see that. So it was a frustrating game, because I don't think City had tons of other chances, to be quite honest. And I saw that argument on Twitter after the game, people like, oh yeah, well, City got this decision, but they could have scored 6 or 7. And I'm thinking back, really, when would they have done that? I didn't see that many chances. Going to the Iwobi discussion, I think the thought process might have been to have another player skilled in possession in the team, because we figured City were going to dominate the ball, so we wanted to be more potent when we got the ball. So to play Iwobi instead of Lacazette, though, I just think it's irresponsible. I think that's where a lot of the problems stemmed from, because all of a sudden, when you were able to turn City over in midfield or catch them on the break, you had one player who could score goals, really. You know, right. You have Ramsey bomb forward, but then he's abandoning his midfield responsibility. So you basically only had Alexis Sanchez up top. And you saw the difference. Once Lacazette came on, he gets a touch, takes a touch in the box, boom, past the keeper, scores. I mean, that's right. Why do you pay all this money for a striker if you're not going to play him in your biggest games?
It's the formation when I saw it come out, like, it, and then like you see the name Coughlin, and then that just, you know, ignites you even more. But like, you see the team come out and you're going, where's Lacazette? Where like I was like, the bench, £50 million for the bench. How is that possible? And I mean, I get Alex Iwobi, but I don't, not in that situation. I think Alexis Sanchez would have done the same exact thing over on the wing that Iwobi probably did, or better. So why not play Lacazette up front and then move Sanchez over and get the same thing out of him? Like, I thought that that move made no sense because you were kind of replacing like for like. You weren't getting anything better. And you were, right. I just didn't see the sense in that part of the lineup.
No, I'm with you. And it absolutely makes no sense. I mean, the decision to play Alexis happened at the end of the transfer window when we decided to keep him. At that point in time, Wenger made the decision that whenever he's fit, he's in the team. Plain and simple. There's no other option. Because you know what? If you were going to keep him out because he's disgruntled, then you should have sold him in the transfer window.
Right.
End of discussion. So he's going to start. We know that. But like you said, the fact that Lacazette was on the bench in that situation, I mean, what? For Alex Iwobi?
Yeah.
Like,
it's mind-boggling.
It really is. And it's not like we had an important midweek game coming up a couple days later where you're saving him for that. And even that would be a questionable decision if you were sending him against City to save him for a midweek game. That would be a mind-boggling decision on its own. But Alex Iwobi, I mean, like you said, Bill, what is he going to give you that's different? Like, what does he bring that we don't already have out there? Yeah, he can dribble the ball, but Alexis can dribble the ball.
Right.
And better. He doesn't play defense. He doesn't track back. Alexis is going to track back a little bit better. He at least tries to organize a press. Right. Iwobi stands there with his whatever. He stands there and doesn't even try and press. He gets back into his own end. He's at fault for the first goal. He gives the ball away at the top of the box. Yeah, the ball moved around a little bit. We didn't clear it, and then KDB scored. But still, the fact that we gave the ball away in that position – directly off of his foot.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing. And I get it. You know, if it was holding, if he was ill, we knew Mertesacker was out. If that's the case, I can understand playing Coughlin's at center back. Personally, I would rather have just slid Kolasinac back in there and with Monreal and figured out the left foot, right foot thing. But you know what? Coughlin wasn't the issue. For me, it's 100%. I mean, I'm not blaming the game on him, but my issue with the lineup is 100% on the decision to start Alex Iwobi. I really don't even see the thought process behind it.
And it's more the domino effect of that, because that means that you have to play Alexis as a striker. When in my opinion,
which he's not good up there. Let's be real. Yeah. He scored a lot of goals there last year, but he's not good as a
against this team.
Yeah, and I think he would tell you, I'd much rather play behind a striker because then I have the freedom to move around, float, and that way if I drop back, there's still someone who's pressed forward into the box to get on the end of chances. It really didn't make any sense to me. Like, if the thought was, well, we're going to struggle to maintain possession, honestly, why not play Jack then, if that's the case? If you are worried about maintaining possession and getting outnumbered in midfield, why wouldn't you just play Jack? You know, he is a guy who's played well against Man City in previous games. I know he's getting back up to speed, but he at least has shown that ability this season that Iwobi really has. And I mean, Iwobi hasn't done much this season, to be candid. And then to stick him in your biggest away game of the season is not fair to the player, and it put the rest of the team in a bind. And, it showed, like, as soon as Lacazette came on, the team becomes more potent going forward. And, you know, then, but by that point, you know, the damage is kind of already done. And then, you know, that third goal pretty much put it out of reach. So it didn't make sense to me. And one thing on the Coughlin thing, just because I'm thinking about it, Elneny has played center back in some of the Europa League games. So I'm not entirely sure why you would use this game to experiment with Coughlin at center back if you had Elneny, who is not a center back by trade, I'll give you that, but he at least has played that position and maybe would have been a better option in terms of passing out of the back, because we weren't able to play out of the back at all. I mean, our build-up play was atrocious. Xhaka was completely outmatched. Ramsey wasn't contributing anything in build-up, and it really kind of hampered our game and allowed City to press us really high up the pitch.
Exactly. And ultimately, like you said, you figure we have to assume we're going to succeed. We're going to give away a lot of possession and we are going to get limited chances. That's the exact kind of striker, the exact kind of situation you need Lacazette in. But you're right, playing Coughlin in the back, we all know how limited he is as far as passing and doing anything going forward. So by playing Elneny in that spot, he's not spectacular, but he can actually pass the ball. You know, he understands the importance of, you know, he understands spatial awareness and how to be in the right position to make himself available for Xhaka, for example, where when the ball gets into Xhaka's feet, he always knows he has an option, especially with Ramsey, who's never around because he just likes to bomb upfield. So I think that was really – that kind of contributed to the fact that we did give up so much possession. But even then, when we did have the ball in the final third, we looked kind of unsure of what to do because we had two players in Iwobi and Alexis who liked to pick the ball up on the left and cut in and try and have a shot. So there wasn't – as much creativity as we really needed and potency going forward for having the limited possession that we did have. So, I mean, I think really with all that being said, I mean, and we kind of touched on it in the beginning, I personally thought we played okay. I think the scoreline is a little bit unfair
kind of for the
flow of the game.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think anytime we were able to get into space, City didn't look great defensively. So we were able to kind of get that at him and pose some threat. And even the announcers afterwards said, or, you know, towards the end of the game, they said, you know, this wasn't a typical Arsenal away performance where they got blown away. Like, they really shouldn't hang their heads too much in the sense that they came here, they tried to play. They didn't get completely exposed defensively, but they had a couple breaks to go against them. And, you know, some of the revisionist history that's kind of happened after the game, people say, oh, well, City didn't have to get out of second gear, this and that. Or, you know, City weren't really at full flow. And I'm like, well, maybe the way Arsenal set up had something to do with that. Or maybe the way the Arsenal players played had something to do with that. Because I think, you know, you could easily make the argument the other way, saying, oh, well, Arsenal didn't really get into their stride. You know, ultimately the way your opponent plays also dictates the way you play to some extent. It's frustrating because I, you know, if you were able to get a draw out of this game, I feel like that would have been a big momentum boost. Now you're kind of going into that Tottenham game, pretty much needing 3 points to stay in touch with the top four. So it's disappointing, but you can't say you're completely surprised by the result. What about you, Bill?
I wasn't surprised by the result. I just, you know, you don't know what, you know, card in the deck of narratives is going to happen on the day. You know, that one was okay. Penalty, that was soft. And offsides goal to, you know, lose the game. You know, a couple weeks ago against Stoke, it was a toenail offside on Lacazette goal not allowed. So, I mean, I wasn't surprised by the result. I kind of thought that they would get outplayed. I didn't think that it was going to come down to a couple of questionable refereeing decisions because I believe that's what it came down to because I agree with Ian and the like in that I thought they played well for the most part, and that's with Alexis playing as bad as he did. Ozil was, you know, kind of questionable at times, I'll have to admit that. But overall, it kind of looked like there were some chances where, as AJ said, the City defense was pretty weak, right? So I thought that they had a chance to score. But as soon as they start getting momentum, something happens that goes against them, and it's unfortunate. And a lot of the times it comes down to refereeing mishaps. I still say that when Wenger pushed Anthony Taylor away in that tunnel, I think that really set the referees really against them in another conspiracy theory of mine. But I really think that because the calls just never seem to go their way, ever.
Well, it's just this idea that the calls even out. I don't believe that, you know.
No, it doesn't happen.
They don't even out unless you're Manchester City, Manchester United, or Chelsea. Because you saw in the Stoke game, the offsides call that the linesman clearly did not see. He guessed on. and then just by me, yeah, like you said, like literally maybe an inch. Whereas you see David Silva called onside when he's literally like 2 feet offside. Mm-hmm. And then you see in the Watford game when Richarlison dove and got that penalty. I mean, we don't get those calls. And then I think Pep Guardiola said something about like, oh yeah, I know, you know, we got this call, but Arsenal got that handball against Burnley last season. I was like, Pep, trust me, if you want to bring up history of your teams getting calls, we can go back to every single Barcelona team you had, every single Bayern Munich team you had, which got every single break in the book. So pipe down with that shit, you know, like it's, but Billy brought up something interesting there, and it's a player that usually comes in for a lot of criticism and sometimes unfairly, in my opinion, but this time I think he actually might deserve some. And that's Mesut Ozil. And you guys know I'm a big fan of his. I love what he does. I think his contributions are often dismissed too easily. He was not good. He really didn't contribute anything. I don't think he created a single chance, if I'm not mistaken. When he got on the ball, he didn't do much with it. He didn't really provide a good outlet. You know, I know it's one of those things where when we can't build for the back, he struggles to influence the game. But in that kind of game, you got to find a way to contribute somehow. And I think he really struggled. Ian, what would you think about his performance?
Yeah, I mean, you can't disagree with that, right? I think in games like that where we do give up so much possession, he can really struggle to find the game and be able to make an impact. I mean, he's not the kind of player that, you know, like Lacazette, for example, where he gets one chance and he's got it in the back of the net. Ozil kind of, if he's completely out of the game and not involved in the game, he does drift out of it. He's not the kind of player that can just all of a sudden come out of nowhere. I mean, he does it from time to time, but in a game like that where we don't have possession, he kind of gets lost. And what I was really looking for out of him was, you know, drop deep into midfield, get on the ball and start making things happen. He just kind of floated through the game and never really tried to step in and put his stamp on the game.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where inevitably the comparisons to De Bruyne are going to happen because they play roughly a similar position, kind of the playmaker. And, you know, you see De Bruyne come up with a goal and just influence the game a lot more, make a lot more of those key passes. And so, yes, De Bruyne has better surrounding talent around him. I don't think anyone with any semblance of a brain would question that. But you still have to figure out a way to contribute. So it's frustrating when your two supposed best players don't show up in that moment. And it's that kind of game which makes you realize just how important Santi Cazorla is, because David Silva was able to play that role for City, where he was that one of those deep central midfielders who is so adept with his thinking and his quick feet and making those short little passes to break through the lines. Santi has that ability, and Xhaka, when he plays in midfield, he's a great long-range passer, and he's good if he's got time, but when he's pressed, he doesn't have the maneuverability and the agility to kind of get around defenders, dribble around defenders, so he either has to force a back pass or he gets turned over, and then Ramsey, that's just not his game, so just the midfield balance was all wrong with this game, and you know, that's why I think the Cazorla void has never really been filled.
Yeah, and you're right, and I think we've kind of all come to the conclusion we're never really going to see him at that level again.
Yeah,
I'm completely confident of that. There's no chance of me. I don't know if you guys saw the pictures of the skin graft of the back of his ankle, where they took the skin from his forearm where his tattoo is, and all part of his forearm tattoo is covering his Achilles. It's crazy. I mean, the man was lucky to not lose his foot completely. Will he come back? I'm sure he'll play again. No, he'll never be the same kind of player, but the point remains that that style of player is something that this team just really, really, really misses. And We've been saying that since Santi went out, since before he went out, when we said he's the only one on our team that can play this game. So we've been saying it for, what, 3 years now?
Yeah.
And we still don't have anybody that could come in and potentially play that position. And that's – but I don't know. That's a huge problem, and you're spot on that in a game when we're under pressure, we need somebody that can break that pressure. Ramsey can't do it. Xhaka can't do it. Ozil's capable of it but won't do it.
Why,
so really, you know,
why is,
where does that leave us?
Why is Wenger continuing to base formations around one player? Where if that one player is not there, it doesn't work. Because that's what seems to be the MO.
I don't know that it's. I wonder if it's more just the squad. I don't know. He's never been somebody that really changes everything. You know what I mean? He's never shown, even back when we were winning titles. I mean, he didn't change his tactics. Right. They did the same thing game in and game out. He found a side that worked, a combination that worked, and just ran it out there time and time again. He's never been known to be a really tactically adept manager. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I think you're right. I think he's a good man manager, or he was a good man manager. He's not anymore, in my opinion.
Right.
He knew how to work with those types of personalities. And then, you know, when the Vieiras and the Henrys left the team, then shaped around Cesc Fabregas, he basically built a team around Cesc Fabregas as – you know, your star in midfield, and then putting players around him like an Arshavin or a Nasri, and then a striker like Van Persie. I mean, everything was built around sort of becoming Barcelona Junior to some extent. Then once Cesc left, there was that void, and he filled it with Santi, and Santi kind of became the cog in that midfield. You know, obviously Ozil was the big attraction, and then Alexis, but you know, Santi has kind of been the heart of the team until he got injured. And, you know, like you said, Ian, that, I mean, he's never going to be a key contributor for Arsenal again. I probably don't think he plays for Arsenal again, quite honestly. So you have to find ways to work around that. But that's where Wenger's lack of tactical awareness and his inability to adapt to the modern game really, really hurts him, because you have to find ways to utilize the personnel you have. You can't just say, oh, well, we don't have a needle type player in midfield, so I guess we're just going to get overrun. Oh, well, you know, it's so, you know, use Jack in that role if you have to. He's the closest you can come in terms of being able to break a midfield press and dribble. I don't know, Bill, what do you think?
Why didn't he just stick with the back four? Even if Coughlin played there, like, I didn't like it, but at least the back four, I was like, you know what? All right. Because I felt it was going to create a little bit more from midfield. Now, I thought Coughlin was going to hurt that by playing in midfield, but I thought at least it would be a little bit more compact, and if he played defensive right in front, it would help out a bunch. When you do that, when he drops back into the middle there and it kind of spreads out, I just think it destabilizes the midfield, and I thought Jack would have been perfect for that game. I thought like a old school, like almost 4-3-3 and like a hybrid where it's like, you know, Alexis and Ozil and then Lacazette up front is like a 2-1, almost tip of a Christmas tree we always talk about type of thing. But I thought at least a back four would have been, you know, really, really good. But as soon as they came out and they weren't in it, I knew that it was going to be trouble.
Right, and it's kind of a problem that we've seen, even in games where we really should dominate the midfield and should dominate possession. It's kind of one of these, not side effects, but trade-offs that you put out there when you play that the formation that we've been playing, the 3-4-3, because you do get outnumbered at midfield. You know, the modern game is big on three-man center midfields. You know, that's what it is, and we continuously get overrun in that area. And but honestly, I'm not expecting Wenger to change. I'm expecting this to be our formation through the majority of the season. I mean, that's where he's set up, that's what he's done, and unless we're falling out of contention, I mean, obviously not contention for the top spot, but unless we kind of go through that massive problem we went through last year, he's not going to change it again. And I think we kind of have to accept that. I mean, we all agree that a different formation would suit this personnel better, but the man has forgotten, you know, as the cliche goes, he's forgotten more football than I'll ever know. And that's, there's no doubt about it that it's true. But he's, it's just not, you know what I mean? Like, I don't really know how to explain it, but
he's,
I think
lost his touch. He's lost his touch, and he hasn't adapted to the way the game has changed. And you look at the switch to the 3-4-3 or whatever you want to call it, 3-4-2-1. It really only came because we had a bad stretch of results and we were conceding goals. And so this was kind of a last ditch effort. And Wenger's problem has always been that he's not a proactive manager. He's a reactive manager. And what I mean by that is, he doesn't anticipate something and change his personnel or change his formation to prepare for that. Something happens, he's caught off guard, and then he changes it. So, you know, rather, you know, he kind of fell into this 3-4-3, 3-4-2-1, and then he saw that it was getting results. He's like, oh, I'm just going to stick with this as long as I can. And the only time I'm going to change it is if we if things get really ugly. But if you look at the numbers, the amount of chances we give up hasn't decreased substantially with the new formation at all. And it, you know, our chances created haven't gone up, you know, much, if at all, to my knowledge. So it's a manager that just does not have the ability to compete in this, at this level anymore with the top clubs. Yeah, you can beat the mid-table teams, the lower-table teams, and maybe even at home you can beat one or two of the top teams. But in terms of attaining the top prizes, the top trophies, I don't see it based on what I've seen so far. I mean, am I being too harsh, Bill?
No, I think you're spot on the money with the assessment. I don't feel any confidence watching really any of their games. Like you said, they'll beat mid-table teams, they'll beat lower-table teams. It's been a stretch for them to win any sort of top game, home or away. I don't understand where the mindset's been, but you know, we always keep talking about it. Common denominator. You know, the manager's been great, and I understand he supposedly attracts top players, but there has to be something else in place, and we're just never going to see anything different. I just don't know how bad it's going to have to get this season for him to want to change the formation. I mean, maybe we saw a hint of it this past week, or was that just a total fluke or just a game? I don't know, but it always seems to, when he drops to a back four in the middle of a game and close out the game well, he does that over and over, but he doesn't start out the game that way.
Yeah. So, and the kind of the funny thing, I mean, for all this doom and gloom that we get to, is we kind of usually end up after a loss with this team. You just look at the table right now. Yeah. City's running away with it, and they're going to, we're 4 points behind United. We're 4 points behind Tottenham, 3 points behind Chelsea, level on points with Liverpool and Burnley for that matter. But you know what I mean? For as poor as I think we've been, and you know, I don't even know that we've been that bad, but we're not obviously not on the same level as City has been this year, but there's a lot of time left. And yeah, there's no confidence in any of us really that we're going to figure it out, because like you guys have both said, Arsene just doesn't show that ability to adapt to it. You know, I think it's important. I think he's going to have to change something for us to kind of hang up with the rest of these sides the rest of the year. And, you know, really hopefully he does, because I don't want to be sitting in six all season. That's for damn sure. You know, we're too good of a club for this shit. So
are we though? That's the thing now.
We should be. And that's
in terms of the prestige of the club. Sure. But
for now, that's slowly being destroyed by ownership.
By ownership and management though.
Ultimately, yeah, by management, but the fact that ownership allows that management to continue is the.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, I think you bring up a good point about where the table stands right now. And, you know, what we do play Tottenham, our next league game is home to Tottenham, so you do have a chance to bridge the gap to them. And Liverpool don't look like anything special this season, although they beat us. I'm just going to chalk that one up as an Ox failure. But, you know, like
100%.
Chelsea, you know, Chelsea beat United, so United are kind of going through a rough patch. So it's really a bunch of decent teams, and then City is up here. Like, and I'll throw this to you first, Ian. I mean, we are functioning under the assumption that City are probably going to walk the league by at least 10, 12 points, right?
Yeah, no doubt in my mind.
Bill, what about you?
I'm going to say around there. I'd say 12 to 15 points, I mean, probably.
They're already 12 points clear of us, 8 points clear of United. 11, we're a third of the way into the season.
And they've got the squad depth. That's the thing.
They're good, man.
They literally brought Gabriel Jesus off the bench. They can bring in a Bernardo Silva off the bench.
Gundogan off the bench.
Yeah, you bring in one of my favorite midfielders, Gundogan, off the bench. I mean, the only place they're a little shaky is at the back defensively. Like, if they lost to John Stones for any extended period, I think they'd be in some trouble.
Yeah, but they score so many goals, who cares?
Yeah, that's the thing. They'll just outscore you.
Exactly.
But, you know, it's one of those things where hopefully we use the international break to kind of reassess and get ready for Spurs. I mean, I know Spurs players had some mysterious injuries that only seem to happen during the international games, and then they have a miraculous recovery for when they play us.
Funny how that always happens, huh?
Yeah, it's just a weird coincidence. I don't know what that issue is. But yeah. Speaking of international breaks, I know we also want to get into a lot of issues plaguing U.S. soccer right now. And guys, if you don't mind, I'm just going to read the latest U.S. soccer roster that was released for the friendly against Portugal. And I'd be curious to get your thoughts once I do. I'll start with you, Bill. But goalkeepers, Jesse Gonzalez, Bill Hamid, Ethan Horvath, defenders, John Brooks, Cameron Carter-Vickers, Eric Lehi, Matt Miazga, Tim Ream, Jorge Villafania, DeAndre Yedlin. In midfield, we have Kellen Acosta, Alejandro Bedoya, Tyler Adams, Lyndon Gooch, Weston McKennie, Kellen Rowe, Danny Williams, and forwards, Juan Agudelo, Dom Dwyer, CJ Sapong, and Josh Sargent. So obviously a lot of youth, a lot of inexperience, but some promising players in there. What kind of sticks out to you, Bill?
I'm liking how, you know, he went, you know, pretty, you know, kind of young in some areas. I like that he brought in some guys that have shown before that they're capable of kind of going up to that next level. Just looking this over a little quickly here. I really like Josh Sargent. First of all, love the name. Can't get any more, I guess, atypical American than that, so to speak. But what the thing that I was trying to find out here is that, you know, I like Yedlin, you know, kind of playing. He's been pretty doing well for Newcastle United. I watched him play the other day. He had a really good game. Who else is in here? I can't find out who I was looking for. But overall, I kind of like the mix that he went in. A lot of inexperience, but there's really nothing else to do at this point but kind of get some guys some shot and see where it goes from there, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm actually really happy with the side. I'm glad that Bedoya is real, not him in particular, but the fact that he's really the only old name, if you want to call it that. I mean, he has got 65 caps. The next is Yedlin with 48. So, I mean, the fact that that's the extent of, you know, really our experience. I mean, after those guys, after him and Yedlin, you're looking at Agudelo with 26 caps as your next most capped player in this team. And really that's kind of what I asked for was a team like this. You know, you've got some guys who have made appearances at this level, but you also have, you know, you're rewarding somebody like Danny Williams for the form he's been in. You're rewarding Josh Sargent for the form he's been in with his U side and kind of the fact, you know, his U-17 World Cup form. I mean, the kid was really good there. I would have liked to seen, like to have seen maybe a couple other younger players. What's his name? Weah, but I forget his first name. But he's training with the Brazil first team with PSG right now.
Oh, so, Timothy Way.
Yeah. So he's getting, he's doing all right training with them for right now. I'm really happy to see Tyler Adams. I think he's had a pretty good season. Can bring some different things to our midfield. Lyndon Gooch, Weston McKennie. Those are names that I'm really happy to see. So I really don't have too much to complain about. Matt Miazga, I'm happy to see him back in there. And now the question is, how many of these guys, are they going to throw out on the field? How much are they going to rely on them? Because it really is a big game. I mean, not in terms of meaning, but level of competition.
Yeah, I think it's an opportunity. I mean, look, after that World Cup qualifying failure, we should look at the roster as a complete reset, meaning most of the guys who are on it should not be on it ever again, and you need to move forward with different players because it's painfully obvious what we had wasn't working. So this is an opportunity. Yes, it's under an interim coach, so you don't know how a future coach would handle these players, but an opportunity to see how these guys play against a really, really good Portugal side. I don't know if Ronaldo's going to be in the squad. I haven't seen anything to that effect. I tend to think he won't be, but I'd have to check on that. Kind of some players who stuck out to me, Cameron Carter-Vickers, he's on loan from Tottenham at Sheffield United in the Championship. And from what I can tell and reports I've been reading, he's been doing quite well there. Ian, you mentioned Matt Miazga. I think that's a really good call up there. Tyler Adams, Weston McKennie. McKennie breaking in through to the Schalke team, and he's one of many Americans at that club. You got Hadji Wright and Nick Tateg. The goalkeeper competition, I think, is really interesting. You've moved past the Tim Howards and the Brad Guzans, I hope. Jesse Gonzalez, I don't watch much FC Dallas, but people rave about him. Bill Hamid was at DC United. Now he's moved to Denmark. And Ethan Horvath has probably competed at the highest level. I think he's played either Champions League or Europa League, games. So a couple of names I would have liked to see. Christian Ramirez for Minnesota United. I probably would have put him in over Dom Dwyer, quite honestly. There's another kid, Jonathan Gonzalez at Monterrey, midfielder, 18 years old. He's kind of become the center of a United States-Mexico duel, but he's been starting regularly in midfield. But I think they have a playoff game coming up, so I think that's why he wasn't called in. But I really can't complain too much. I mean, the forward pool is really light. I think that's one thing that sticks out. Agudelo, I mean, he is what he is. Dom Dwyer's not young. CJ Sapong would have been an interesting call-up maybe 2-3 years ago, but there's an opportunity for a Josh Sargent to make an impression. And I think that's really all you can ask for. But I mean, if you were going to pick maybe one guy to this roster that you're really excited to see, who would you say? I'll start with you, Ian, on that one.
I mean, the one guy, probably Weston McKennie would be number one for me. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to see a lot of Josh Sargent. I think he may get a few minutes at the end of the game, if anything. But I kind of excited to see how he looks with a more senior side. It's not really the full senior side, but as far as guys who I think you're going to see get some good game time, I'm hoping to see Weston McKennie. I think, that kid doing what he's doing with Schalke, it's going to be really exciting to kind of see how he fits into this team.
Bill, what about you?
I know we're probably not going to get to see a lot of Josh Sargent. That's really who I would like to see get some good game time, honestly. I think he brings some excitement to the game, scores some good goals. But besides that, I think you mentioned him, AJ, Cameron Carter-Vickers. I like that we may be able to see some game time from him and kind of see what he's made of, even though he has some Spurs blood in him.
Yeah, we got to get that out of him. He's got to change that for sure.
Right.
But, I think the fact that we're onto this young side, that's a good sign. But like you said, it is an interim coach.
Right.
And it ultimately, it doesn't matter what we do with this friendly, or what this interim coach does with this team, it's going to come down to really what happens at the top of U.S. soccer. And since we last kind of talked, we've had some interesting developments as far as who's kind of thrown their hat into the ring, namely Eric Winalda. Now we've seen Kyle Martino is going to take a run at it. A couple of other, you know, U.S. soccer, MLS, SUM, Yes Men, one of Gulati's right-hand man. But the most interesting thing to me, to be completely honest, is the fact that we haven't heard a single thing from Sunil Gulati whether he's going to run or not. I mean, he said he's not going to step down, but he hasn't said one way or another what he's going to do going forward. I mean, to me, that's the most interesting thing. Alex, what do you think?
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I think that is kind of the biggest question, because with the pool of candidates as it is, there's going to be a lot of vote splitting amongst those people. And conceivably, if Gulati ran, he's almost a sure thing to get reelected, just with the way the system works. And candidly, my understanding of the voting system is a little limited, but just from what I've read and from what people who are paid to know more about this than I do have said, it would be pretty easy for him, but you've not heard anything yet. And I wonder if he's maybe waiting for a lot of the negativity and a lot of the anger to die down before he announces it. I got news for you, Sunil. It's not going to get any better. People are still going to be pissed off. So if you are running, may as well announce it and get, you know, let people get their anger out. Their deserved anger, I might add. Bill, where do you kind of stand on the Gulati issue? Do you think he runs again? And if he does run again, like, are we right back to square one?
If he runs again, he's going to win. That's for sure. There's no way around it. Like you said, the pieces are already on the board, positioned for him to get reelected if he plays. And the taking away votes is a great point, because I was going to allude to that as well. People are going to steal votes from each other with all of these people all of a sudden getting, you know, peacock syndrome, walking around thinking that they're huge. They're going to run for U.S. president of the federation here. It's crazy, you know, some of these guys that are running, and I'm looking at the list of all these people that wonderful Alexi Lalas has been bantering off. I think he's like running some sort of private campaign, by the way. I don't know what he's been doing, but he's just,
yeah, his campaign is called Let's Maintain the Status Quo.
Yeah, that's his, that might be flying on banners and on planes over his head as we speak. But it's some of these people that are running are blowing me away. And this, some of them are just kind of go with the wind. I mean, there's a couple of these people on here that are kind of like, what are you doing? And I mean, I was mentioning today, Winalda, you know, has always been outspoken and fought against the system, even on TV when he was on Fox. But he's very much grassroots. You know, he has a lot of good ideas there and can get a lot of things going there. But can he do stuff on a more advanced level? That's the issue, is we don't know a lot of these people's acumen to be able to do it. But maybe does it need to start at that level? You know, you don't know. I mean, I think Winalda's kind of a goof, but, you know, he's not really that bad of a guy. And some of his ideas do kind of make sense from what I looked at. But so do some of these other candidates on here that I looked at as well. It's just going to be a very interesting situation. I don't really want to talk too much about Kyle Martino, because I just can't even believe that he's running.
You know, the thing about Martino, and I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. I know my feelings about him are a little bit different than yours. I don't mind him.
They're not a little bit different. They're substantially different. Right.
Yeah.
That's fair. Yeah, that is fair. I don't mind him. He is kind of a company line yes man. Follow the...
Yeah, that's not me. I can't do it.
As an analyst, I hear you. I don't disagree with any of that. I really want to hear what his platform is. I mean, I get the impression that he's not for promotion relegation. But he's also kind of more for changing a lot of some of the other things. He's almost a little bit more, he's more conservative than Wijnaldum, has some of the same ideas, but he's not blow everything up and change everything. So it's going to be interesting to see kind of who starts gaining the traction. Alex, your point about whoever made the point about Alexi Lalas, that does kind of concern me. I could see him, you know, a month from now, not maybe, it's got to be sooner than that, saying, you know what, these guys are a bunch of clowns. I just asked everybody all these questions. All their answers suck. Here's my answer to all of these questions. This is why I'm running. Right? I could completely see that being his strategy,
It seems it kinda, man.
And it seems like something that he would do.
You're talking about Lawless, you mean?
But yeah, Lawless. Right. But the thing about Lawless is he said it himself. He's an entertainer. He's not a pundit. He's not an analyst. He's an entertainer, and he has said it. So I'm not just putting words in his mouth or kind of or claiming things. He said that about himself.
Right.
So I don't know that he would necessarily want to put that much pressure on himself to really do that. He can keep doing his thing and let everybody else get out there and muck it up and just sit on the outside and be like, you guys are all idiots. Look at me. I have all the answers.
Yeah, no, I'm not worried about Lawless running because that would require an original thought, and he hasn't had one in about 10 years. So I'm really not worried about that.
Or he's just going to pick and choose what everybody else says.
Yeah, no, because if you look at his Twitter interactions, and I don't want to spend too much time talking about him, although I do have something later that pissed me off, as usual. But basically, he's now all of a sudden playing Mr. Investigative Journalist, asking the tough questions. Oh, since you're running for U.S. Soccer President, what are your thoughts on kneeling for the anthem? What are your thoughts on promotion or relegation? As if he somehow cares about progress. Guys,
he's
like him,
mocking it.
Yeah, exactly. Like he does not want change in U.S. soccer. That's what people need to realize. People like Alexi Lalas are the status quo. And right. He represents everything that needs to change in this system. He does not want the game to progress because then relics like him become irrelevant. I'm just going to quickly go through the list of candidates, and I kind of want to get your guys' takeaways. I'm just going to give a brief summary here. Steve Gans is an attorney. It says that he promises to spend more time focusing on issues at the youth level. Doesn't have a whole lot in terms of what he would do for the women's team. There's Paul Lapointe. He's a businessman, and he's a manager of United Premier League Soccer League in Rhode Island. I don't know what that is. But he says he'd institute promotion relegation, focus on expanding access to the sport at the lower levels, and then have a U.S. Open Cup style tournament for women's soccer. There's Michael Winnegard. He's another lawyer because what the world needs is more lawyers. and, you know, he's got a background more in the coaching aspect, and he doesn't really seem to be prioritizing like promotion relegation. Paul Caligiuri, another former U.S. player, is probably the newest one in the pool, and he really hasn't given tons of specifics. So there's Carlos Cordero, who's the vice president, and that was kind of a big thing that he's running because people are like, well, maybe that means Gulati's not running. Anyone linked to Gulati should not be elected, my opinion. And then, you know, obviously you have Wijnaldum and Martino. And when I initially heard about Martino's entrance, I thought, okay, well, let's see what he's got. But now I'm reading his rhetoric. Really nothing about it is substantive. You know, he's talking about transparency and equality. He doesn't seem to have many answers about pay to play. He doesn't seem to have much about promotion relegation. And my concern with him and Bill, I think you've been spot on with this, is he's too status quo for me. Mm-hmm. He spent his entire career in MLS. He never went abroad. He doesn't have a global perspective. He's too entwined with the status quo for me. And so that kind of leads me to a question that I'll pose to you, Ian. I mean, how important do you think it is to be a former player? Do you think that should matter here if one of these other candidates perhaps has better ideas but doesn't have the playing experience?
No, I don't think, you know, being a player, it doesn't matter to me. I think it gives you a different perspective. If you use that perspective to see the issues and say, you know, like kind of like Wijnaldum is doing, talking about all the issues with U.S. soccer, cool. Like, it gives you a different perspective. But you can also, you know, just the opposite can be said. You can say, hey, look, I turned out okay. I made it pro. I made it to the national team. The system's fine. So it's just a matter of how that candidate decides to look at it. And I think it gives them an interesting, like I said, a different perspective, a little bit more experience. And so, no, I don't think it really matters. And honestly, my last thing on Martino, I'm not saying he's going to be a good candidate. I'm just saying I don't know. I want to hear his own original thoughts. We all know that as an analyst on NBC, he's a talking head. Every single one on NBC is a talking head. So I'm going to give him a chance. He said he's going to Mexico with his family for a few days, and then he's going to come back. He's going to lay everything out for everybody. Cool. You know what? I'm going to give him the benefit of that doubt, which I'm going to give to every single candidate out there. I just want to hear him speak for himself before I say no, go home. You know what I mean?
Well, and let's be honest. The other thing is none of us get a vote on this, and that's the frustrating part. It's all handled by these delegates and different committees and councils. And there's an article, I think I'll retweet it later, that kind of explains the process. But and Bill, you kind of alluded to this too. Winalda says a lot of things. He is very outspoken. He is often vague on details, though, and that is a little concerning to me because I follow him on Twitter, and sometimes he'll say, you know, like after the U.S. has a bad result, he'll say, "Oh, well, there are ways to fix this," and I know some of them, and people are like, "What are they? What are these ways? Like, what are you referring to?" He's like, "Oh, well, I can't tell you because people will get mad at me." Well, here's your chance, Eric. If you've got specifics, now's the time. I will say I really do like how strongly he came out for equal pay for women because, you know, let's face it, women's soccer has been so successful in this country. And I definitely think there's something to that. The deal, the collective bargaining deal that they struck, he said he'd rip that up and give a new one. And he has been so outspoken about implementing promotion relegation. And that's not the be-all, end-all of U.S. soccer, in my opinion. But I do think it's a substantial step that needs to be taken. And he does have coaching experience. So I think he understands problems at the grassroots level. And I think more than any other candidate, he understands all the different demographics that are being left out of talent development. Because he's talked about that. He said, you know, look, I've looked in inner cities. I've looked in these different places to find young players. There is talent there. We just need to find it. I don't know what's your thinking on what you've heard from Winalda, and his kind of his platform, Bill.
Winalda has at least been speaking of these things for a length of time. Like if we're comparing the two versus Martino and him, at least from that perspective, I've heard more for longer from following him on Twitter because he actually doesn't have me blocked and he actually follows me, by the way. So, you know, he has my vote right there if I could vote.
There's one media member that has not blocked Bill.
And follows me.
That explains why he's in his corner.
No,
that makes a lot of sense now.
But if we're honestly really comparing the two, you brought up a lot of the points. He's talked about those issues, the equal pay, the promotion relegation. No concrete details on that, but at least is pro those ideas. So maybe could get a team together or whatever panels and all these people do and get things together and ideas rolling forward on how to start that process. Because currently there's not even any talk about doing it. So at least at that level, it's at least pure in the aspect that he'll probably try to do what, you know, he thinks is best that, you know, a lot of people do want to see from all his experience doing all the things that you mentioned. Martino, I feel, is very flavor of the month. Status quo, whatever way the wind is blowing, he's going to go that way. He does it with his analysis all the time. For a couple of years, he was Arsenal. I loved him. I was tweeting him how amazing he was. It was like, you know, happy, everything was great. And then all of a sudden, he just, you know, the thing was to bash Arsenal again real hard the past couple of years. He's just jumped on board. But, you know, so like, I think, you know, in terms of that, like, I think it's just kind of like, this is kind of like the thing I want to do. I think I can make a change. You know, I'm going to kind of throw my hat in the ring and see what happens. I don't know. I just don't think he has anything concrete. I don't trust his relationship with Arena. I don't trust some of the quotes that he has said in the past. I don't know if this last thing has changed him and inspired him to be different or do something, but I don't know. I don't know if Ronaldo is going to be good either. I just know that his ideas he's talked about for a long time, and most of them a lot of people would like to see.
And I do agree. I think that's an important thing, is that, you know, you can't go back and you can't say to him, well, you know, where were you on this a year ago? Because he was out there about it. He really was. And I do think that's an important thing. Mm-hmm. But honestly, he's really the only candidate that we've heard a ton about. I mean, everybody else, we're kind of guessing just based on their associations, really what their thoughts are. So it's going to be interesting to see where everybody comes out. But unfortunately, like I think it was Alex, like you said, none of us actually get to vote. You know, so it's really going to come down to who can these people influence, and that's kind of a scary thing, because how much of those voters, and I really think that this is going to go to your point about if Gulati decides to run, he's going to get reelected. How many of the people who can actually vote for this, how many of those people are just, you know, have their pockets lined by Gulati?
It's a fair question, because – I mean, Gulati's been in charge for what, like, I don't know, like 15 years or so, something like that. He's run pretty much unopposed every single time. This is the first time that he's had real competition. And Bill, you alluded to something that I think is really interesting, that you said, like, a lot of people are only pointing out these issues now, and Ronaldo is someone who's pointing them out before. Or Ian, you had mentioned that too, like, these issues didn't just surface within the past month since we failed to qualify for the World Cup. And that's what people aren't understanding. These issues have been years in the making. Mm-hmm. The fact that we haven't been able to develop from the grassroots level didn't start recently. This has been the case for a long time. Pay to play has been an issue. Equal pay for the women's team has been an issue. Now people are seeing it as, oh, well, see, we failed and I have the solution. Well, where were you people last year? That's the question. And that's where Ronaldo has a little bit of my leaning. Like, not that it matters, because like you said, we can't vote. But if I were on that council or committee or whatever it is that votes, I would lean that way, because he identified these problems early on through his own experiences coaching and playing in Europe. He played in the Bundesliga. He knows what talent development looks like. But I guess I'll throw this question out to you. Like, I mean, what do you view as the key issue in U.S. soccer right now? If you had to name one thing where you're like, this needs to be fixed first. I mean, Ian, would you say it's promotion relegation? Would you say it's pay to play, equal pay? What is it?
Man, that is such a heavy question to throw out there with like 3 minutes left in the podcast.
That's why I gave it to you.
Oh, man. There's so many issues. I mean, I think you probably hit the two biggest right there. Pay to play, promotion relegation. I kind of think they both go hand in hand. Actually, and another thing that I think was a big deal also, that I don't know if you guys saw this, and I don't know if it's official yet, but I did see an article today that MLS was instituting a new rule that now clubs can sell their homegrown players and keep all of the profit. Because previously the clubs would only get 25% of that money for the player that they sold. So for example, if Tyler Adams was to get sold to Newcastle for $8 million, well, Red Bulls would get $2 million and MLS would get $6 million. That's how it was set up. So where in the world is their motivation for the clubs to develop their own homegrown players? Even if they're going to keep them or they're just going to sell them, there is none, because they're not going to get the money for them. So to me, that's actually a big step in the right direction, kind of giving more incentive to those clubs to develop from their academies and invest more in their academies. Promotion, opening up the system, adding promotion relegation, that will do the same. That's going to put more emphasis on developing your club from the bottom up and not just saying, oh, you know, we're having a bad year. Let's just wait for the draft and get a new player. You know, you can't do that anymore. You have to have that academy, that fallback to keep a steady pipeline of players coming through. And on top of that, that still to me ties into promotion relegation. That still all ties into pay to play. Because to me, the idea of getting rid of pay to play is opening up the system. It's opening up opportunities for players who normally wouldn't have them. Because right now, the only way to find your way through the program is to get into the U.S. development camps when you're 12, 13, 14. And if you're not getting into those camps, you're not getting your chance with the national program. So by kind of opening everything up on a whole level, on a broad level, I think, you know, that really, it all really works together. So I think that's one issue for me. I don't see promotion relegation and pay for play as separate issues. Technically, yes, they are, but I think they're really deeply entwined in how they would work and how they both work together. So my short answer to your question.
No, I think there's a, I think the way you summarize kind of how all these elements work together was spot on, to be honest. And Bill, what's kind of your take on that?
The take on what Ian said?
Yeah.
I mean, it can't be just one issue. Like I think when E was saying how they're all kind of connected, I mean, you really have to kind of look at the system as a whole and find out what pieces are part of the foundation that will then in turn make the other things work and more excitable. Having promotion and relegation, I think, you always hear the talk about bringing the communities having them more involved, but you know, it's the truth where then, you know, having homegrown players and having a sense of pride playing for a club that you grew up watching may be more important, where if there is no pay to play and there is a better kind of youth setup, maybe there is a way to make that dream or that, you know, vision kind of happen for somebody. So there's a lot of other intangibles that I think have to be looked at, but everything is connected, but it all has to be worked out and installed and implemented in the right order and with the person with the right vision. It's just, do we have that in any of these candidates?
Yeah, and it really is a question of how best to implement that vision and that long-term plan for U.S. soccer, because it does have to be a long-term plan. This isn't a short-term situation at all, and there's no quick fix here. You know, for me, the biggest issue is grassroots development and how much talent is slipping through the cracks. And you guys will have to indulge me on this. I know we're kind of wrapping up, but you got to indulge me on something I read that I've heard Alexei Lalas say before, but it's just,
don't you give this man credit.
It irks me so much. So he was asked the question, in terms of developing talent and what's going on from an academy standpoint, how do you think we're doing? He said, I think we're actually doing relatively well considering a couple factors. First and foremost, I don't think we're at the point now where talent is slipping through the cracks. I think that if you are good, eventually there's enough of a network where you will be seen. And I'm not saying there's not a couple players that will go off and do good things and maybe weren't recognized, but that happens anywhere, okay? I don't think there's all this talent out there underground and slipping through the cracks that maybe it was before. First of all, there isn't enough of a network to see all these players because U.S. Soccer's scouting network is actually really limited. There aren't enough people to see all these players in all the different regions. But here's the part that irked me. He says, now, the second part of it is that our country is unique in the makeup and the geography and just the actual size. And I think that's where the biggest challenge is when it comes to development. This recognition that while our diversity as a country is what makes us great, it's also our biggest challenge. Then he goes on to say that at times can be incredibly challenging when you're trying to build a team, because recognizing and articulating a way you want to play means that sometimes people aren't going to fit into that. So while as a country, we pride ourselves on being inclusive in terms of developing teams and developing players, you might actually have to look at being more exclusive. I know when you say that, it means some very, very good players might not fit into development situations and systems that we put in place. And that scares the bejesus out of Americans, because the worst thing in the world is we have talent that goes unrealized. That to me is the most backwards thinking I've ever heard when it comes to developing players. So you're saying that because we need the supposed unified vision, there should be one group that dictates what this vision is, and everyone who doesn't fit into that vision is excluded. We need to be more exclusive and only limited to the select few. Well, if that's the case, you're going to have upper middle class white kids making up the U.S. national team for the rest of our lives. Mm-hmm. That is basically what that means. It's not a race thing. It's just a class thing, really, because that's what the sport is right now. It is upper middle class. Most people can't afford to play on these travel teams or go to these academies. So to say that we need to be more exclusive means you are limiting Latino kids, you're limiting kids from the inner cities, you're limiting kids from the Midwest who don't necessarily have access to the nicest facilities. And when you do that, you're eliminating 50, 60%. I'm so animated, I almost knocked my printer off the table. You're limiting so much of your player pool because we haven't implemented a structure to utilize these different demographics. And I genuinely can't understand that thought process. And that's why I say someone like him represents the status quo. He's perfectly fine if things stay the way they are, because he benefited from that system. If you want to compete, not even with the Brazils and the Argentinas and the Germanys, if you want to compete with teams like Chile or Mexico, or, you know, I know Chile didn't make the World Cup, so that's a bad example, but like a Mexico consistently, and some of these upper echelon teams, you have to find a way to be more inclusive.
That's exactly right. I mean, the fact that he can even go out there, that he's even going to go out there and say it, I mean, at one point in time in that statement, I forget what you said, it was almost making sense. And then he went on the whole thing about being exclusive and just absolutely blew my mind. That's the first time I heard that comment. Kind of the interesting thing, another thing that I picked up was his talk about he doesn't think anybody is slipping through the cracks. Well, yeah, that's because these players aren't even being brought along to the point. They're falling through the cracks before they even have a chance to step over them. Right? Like, that's a really poor analogy, but hopefully you guys understand where I'm coming with that, is that we're losing out and missing on so much potential and talent at that youth level, that 12, that U10, U11, U12. We miss out on so much talent because we're not cultivating it in the right way. We're not giving that talent the opportunities to get to the next level where they could fall through the cracks. Like, we're not, like, when he's saying that, he's talking about players between 14 and 16 who, you know, are really good and have, you know, could be even better, and those players are just getting missed. We're missing these players when they're 10. We're missing these players when they're 9, when they're 11, at that age. We're not missing players at 17 years old. The problem is we're not taking those players we have at 17 and taking them to the next level because they're going to college or they're playing in MLS. You know, there's, like you said, there's so many issues at every step along the way. And the fact, I'm not even going to talk about it, that exclusive thing, because like you said, you could not make a more backward statement. You really couldn't.
And that's the thing, like, and I'll throw this to you, Bill, as we kind of wrap things up. You know, this, I get the logistical concern that the country is huge and it's hard to get to all these people, but
so hire more scouts.
Like, I realize, like, money doesn't grow on trees. U.S. soccer has plenty of money, so I really don't want to hear that. You know, I've heard about the cash reserves that U.S. soccer has. It's tens of millions of dollars. You telling me you can't hire 40-50 more scouts to whose sole job it is to explore and check out youth games, see what people in different states are doing, what local coaches are doing, you can't do that and then somehow have like a, you know, like kind of a convention where these scouts can meet and say, look, this is what they're doing in Texas right now. And I saw this youth team in Houston that looked really good. And they've got this type of player, you know, there has to be some level of coordination. And, you know, there are logistical concerns. I get that. But if you want, if you're genuinely serious about taking U.S. soccer to the next level, that's what needs to be done. I mean, Bill, I mean, how do you rectify some of these issues?
I mean, you're right about Alexi. Like, he's going to stay with the system that benefited him, you know? And, you know, some of the things that, you know, he's saying can't be done are just being excuses being made to not change that same system. But you need to set up some sort of scouting network that is much larger than ours. I mean, the country's bigger, but, you know, scouts go all over Europe too. You know what I mean? And I know, understand the size difference is still there with that, but you set up a bigger system, you set up a kind of scholarship type programs, different sort of things with that, and get better coaching requirements, better coaching setup in the country from top to bottom, and try to kind of unify it. There's just too many things to kind of go over, but it's possible to start from there and kind of go forward. Lawless, I think, just spews just pompous arrogance with his tweets, and I don't know what he gets out of it. I don't know if he's a gigantic troll, but yes. I think that there are answers to this question, but they just have to be looked at. And like you said, people have to go out and see what everybody's doing in different states, see what's happening, kind of get these young players to get involved, be able to pay their fares to go to different tournaments around the country, things of that nature, to get them exposed and interested where they keep playing the sport throughout, and then building up the pro system where they could possibly enter in that at an earlier age. There's just so many things that can be done and done better.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just kind of to wrap up, like we're finally trying to get to here, the fact that there is that diversity in the youth game across this country shouldn't be seen as a detriment. You should see that as a positive. The fact that we have so many players from so many different backgrounds that come through so many different ways of coaching and styles of play, that should be used as a positive, because it's something that other countries just can't bring. You want to Americanize soccer and you want to do it the American way? Well, there you go. That's the American way. You take the diversity of talent and ability and styles that this country can produce and you bring that to the national team level, not push all of that away to go with one style of player. Well, I think that's where I come out. And I think, you know, we can obviously go on and on and on about this, and we absolutely will again, especially as we get closer to this election. And I really wish that we actually could have a vote in all this shit, right? Yeah. That we could actually have a say that, you know what I mean? Somebody who knows, who's listening to this, send this portion of our podcast to everybody who can vote. Tell them to listen, because we spit some wisdom out there that all of those people need to hear before they vote for this next president. I'm sorry we can't give you any money. I mean, I got a fiver in my wallet if somebody wants it, but that's about all I can do to bribe somebody to vote for the right person. And I'm sure Gulati is going to give them a hell of a lot more. So on that note, send this over to Alex. Throw out Twitter handles. Where can we find everybody?
Yeah, so obviously you can find me at UFGoonerAJ. Billy O, you can find at AFC Gruner O. My boy Ian, you can find at GunnersFan6. Find the podcast at EuroSnobPod. Facebook.com/EuroSnobPod. Also, if you're watching this on YouTube, I'm so sorry you had to see our faces. But we'll hopefully do this as a regular thing. And, you know, share, like, subscribe, do whatever you got to do to spread the word, folks.
Absolutely. Going to stream these every time we do it from now on. You can catch all the videos from this season all on our YouTube channel. We'll share that link with everybody as well. So any final words for you, Bill?
Now I hope everybody enjoys the podcast. Make sure you subscribe, tell everybody about it, listen in, and take care. Look forward to that next Arsenal game. Should be exciting.
I sure hope so. And I don't know when we're going to come, when we're going to get with you guys for another podcast. I know we're kind of coming into that Thanksgiving, Thanksgiving week somewhere along then. So if you don't hear from us before then, you know, everybody enjoy Thanksgiving. Really just remember, you know, the point of the holiday. It's not to go out and shop. It's about to be thankful for everything you have. So take that in mind when you're sitting down drinking your beer, your wine, eating all your delicious food. And on that note, guys, I want to say thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch up with you sometime soon.
All right. Thanks, guys.
See ya.